Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. One of the big ideas that's running in the background of this whole series about ethics beyond religion is the thought that when it comes to finding a way of thinking about a more universal framework for ethics, sometimes religion gets in the way. And I want to just say, please notice all the words in that sentence. I feel as though, culturally speaking, I know culture's not a monolith, but painting with broad strokes here, we're constantly being conditioned by soundbite presentations to listen in smaller and smaller ways with reduced contextual awareness. What I said was, sometimes religion gets in the way. And we should also say that when it comes to having and living a good ethic, religion is sometimes helpful. I've said something like this every time I've touched on this topic. We're not exploring ethics without religion. We're exploring ethics beyond religion. And that doesn't feel to me like something I need to say to defend something as much as to keep it present to our consideration in all of this. And in other words, what we're working toward here and taking our sweet time about, because we keep dipping in and out of it, but we'll keep returning. What we're working toward here is a way to think about what is good and right that isn't limited by any particular religious take on that, but that could be shared by all persons regardless of how they identify in religious terms. So that's kind of the gold standard in this exploration. A bunch of what I'm about to say here might feel terribly obvious, but I want it to sort of be in our shared space. Our religious orientation or commitments are matters of identity. I am a fill in the blank is a statement of identity. I am, in terms of religious identity, we might say, I'm a Christian, I'm a Buddhist, I'm spiritual but not religious, I'm an atheist, and so on. Those are all statements of identity. We make these same sort of statements around lots of categories. So it's a category, right? Categories like gender, roles in a family or a group, our ethnicity, our education, our occupation, our achievements, perhaps especially in the last 6 weeks or so, our nationality. To put it another way, these are all different ways of seeing who we are. They're ways of considering who we are. And how we think about who we are has a profound influence on how we behave. How we see ourselves impacts what we expect of ourselves. You ever find yourself, this is a rhetorical question, you don't need to answer, but do you ever find yourself behaving differently in a work setting than at home? as a person who sometimes also does work facilitating conversations in workplaces, I've had this conversation with lots of people, right? We do some particular exercise that identifies a theme in personality or behavior, and on the break somebody comes up to me and says, but I just want you to know I'm not like that at home. Like that actual sentence. I'm like, is this a problem? Like, we could, you know, what is it that you're really trying to say? So here's the question. Are both of those versions, let's assume that they are sometimes different, are both of those versions of you or I authentic? Because they can be different, yes? Like, don't want to assume this is true for anyone in particular, but it wouldn't be unusual. I think that is tied in no small part to what we're exploring together this morning. How we see ourselves influences what we expect of ourselves, and what we expect of ourselves deeply impacts how we behave. I don't know if you'll find this helpful at all, but
I sometimes think of these identities that we all carry as being like moons that are in kind of a swirling orbit around what we might call ourself. And most of us think of ourselves in several different ways in terms of identity, as I just mentioned. We're not just our gender or our ethnicity or our religion or our occupational identity. We're all of these. And we can often sort of switch identities, which in my metaphor there is like jumping from one moon to another, depending on our context. At least we can jump from one moon to another when the context is cooperating, when things are working well. So we can behave professionally at work, for example, most of the time. This is one of the ways to understand why the office party is stereotypically understood as a professional occupational hazard. Okay? Inebriation depresses the central nervous system and it makes it hard to consistently behave an identity, especially if that identity behavior requires conscious maintenance. If you have to be vigilant to be professional, and your vigilance is impaired, right? Drunken mistake can cover a lot of ground. But one way to think about it is as a moment where we got wobbly and we didn't do a good job of jumping from one moon to another, or we tried to make the leap and missed, or we just plain forgot which moon we were on. To use a different and maybe closer to home example, we might swear like a sailor if we bash our thumb working on a project in the garage at home. This is not a true story, by the way. But deal with physical pain in a professional or workplace setting by going, ah, right? You know, no deleted expletives. How we see ourselves in those different settings impacts how we behave. Our identity impacts how we behave. Our ethics, our moral principles, govern our behavior or our conduct in a particular setting. And how we behave, including how we behave our ethics, comes from how we see ourselves. So here's where we come, in some ways, to the challenge. As we've just been considering, it's a pretty simple matter to see ourselves differently in terms of identity or even identities plural, and to have that help us understand why we also behave differently in different settings, but also why we behave differently from one another. So this is a part that makes the world interesting, right? I would shudder to think of a world full of me's. Like, can you, you don't have to, but can you imagine like an entire society of people who just want to talk about ideas? whatever feature we might draw to illustrate that. Now, on a good day, we're even intrigued by those differences, right? We're attracted to them, hence opposites attract and tropes like that. But here's the thing. We don't, of course, behave in isolation, ever. Our behavior impacts others. So how we see ourselves impacts how we do and live out our ethics. It also helps us differentiate ourselves from others, which sets us up to readily see ethics through a not like me or not like mine lens, a lens of othering. And this is, as we can probably easily imagine, in tension with finding common ground, right? If I'm seeing someone as, quite readily seeing someone as different from me, and I have this mission of trying to find out what we have in common, those things are pulling in opposite directions, potentially. And I said intention because, as with many human challenges, I don't think it's necessarily in opposition. It's not the opposite of so much as it is another aspect of. Differentiating ourselves from others is not a bad thing, and it can become a bad thing, right? So both and. So, given the power and the importance of identities and the fact that many of the ways that we identify are most easily understood in terms of different than, where might we productively turn to see what we have in common? If identity is a tricky starting place, what if we started somewhere else? Because if we can't make progress on this, it's going to be pretty difficult to make progress on shared ethics, because we're just going to stay stuck in self-identity and self-interest. And I think that if we're willing to be honest with ourselves, we can see at a glance how unfettered self-interest plays out, and it is not lovely. Let me put this as simply as I can for my own benefit, and then see if it resonates for you. I'm going to pose this as a question. What do we, humans, what do we all have in common? So we're looking for something universal. Let's just zoom out as far as we can. Well, we're all human. So seriously, Tim, all the buildup to get us to that, I would say yes, because there are so many powerful factors that make it easy to actually lose sight of this. It's the fact that we're all human is the one way in which all 8 plus billion of us are 100% the same. It is the center of our common ground. We're human. That's as close as I could get to the core of the onion. And if you want to look at a species getting nervous about its core identity, all you have to do is tap into any conversation that suggests that a machine might learn enough to behave like one of us. And then very quickly, if you keep going down that path, you'll encounter some thinker or other who says, and here's how that can never happen, and feel like that's a really important argument to make. And underneath of all of that is a way of saying, yes, but it's not human. So at the center of the kind of layers of this for me is that idea. This is the thing that we all have in common, the center of our common ground. We are all human. But almost the instant that we get past the very simple way I just said this, we're all human, we're back into the terrain of difference. Right? It's like it's just right there. I don't even know if it's right there. It's like, how do you illustrate interwoven, right? It's not even close together. They're just intertwined. Because what it means to be human isn't something we all agree about. And in fact, it's something that keeps changing as we learn more about both ourselves and other living beings. You don't have to go very back in the history of thought about what it means to be human to encounter big dogmatic ideas that say, here's what differentiates us from every other living thing, that have already fallen by the way. Like for a long time, it was language. It's no longer language. The more we learn about the way other living beings communicate, we're like, nope, that's not it. That's not the thing. Because other living things have language. Anyway, don't want to get stuck in the philosophical weeds. But all to say, the difference part shows up right away. We can come back to this. But the fact that we keep learning more and more about what it means to be human is one of the reasons why many folks find it increasingly difficult to take ancient mythologies as literal frameworks for defining humanness. Because we now know things that the folks who wrote those stories didn't know that assail some of the core understandings of this in the stories. I'm not going to illustrate that. I'm just going to set that to the side and carry on. But I want to start with the basics of what we have in common. So as humans, we all have bodies. We are all material. And that's important, but it's not enough. And the reason that it's not enough is actually pretty simple. At a material level, there is no qualitative difference between the matter that makes up a human being and a rock. Interestingly enough, something that shows up in all kinds of mythologies, including the Hebrew ones in the book of Genesis, right? What are humans made from? The earth. It also shows up, it's sort of in other spaces we'll talk about in a moment, but both of those examples, a human and a rock, are at a material level an aggregation of really small particles. Making big things very simple here. But contemporary science points to a couple of interesting ideas on this front, including the notion that all matter is endlessly being recycled, including the matter that we're made up of, and that the very atoms that make up our bodies once belonged to the stars that are very distant from this place, both in space and time. So hence the language of humans being made up of stardust, as well as the language that shows up at the other end of our life experience, where we might quote a sacred text that says, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. That's an image that showed up in the play that we saw last night, where the characters start out as coming from ashes and return to ashes in the end. So, as humans, we have that in common. We're all made out of the same material stuff. And there may be some ways in which acknowledging that commonality can inform how we think about what right behavior looks like, in the sense that it can potentially, at least, help us dial down our hubris about a particular point of view. Whoever you and I might be, whatever we might believe, it's all going to get recycled in the end. So simmer down, you know? Like, just zoom out a little bit in terms of, I have to be right about this. This is why, for example, in Buddhism, probably most visibly at this point in idea exchange in the West, but shows up in lots of reflective practices. This notion that one of the things that can help us make better decisions is if we ask ourselves a question, even 100 years from now, how much is this going to matter? Like the thing that I am just having it out with somebody about. Really? How big a deal is this if I just step back that step? That kind of thinking. So it can help us with that. We're all going to get recycled. So really? You want to hurry that? You want to speed that up? You want to just stand back a little bit and go, no, that's okay. I can think about this another way. At the risk of pressing the analogy until it snaps, getting too precious about my perspective on something might be a little bit like getting attached to a drink container. Like, it doesn't mean that the drink container is useless. It just means that it has a function in context and it isn't the be-all, end-all. As the ad campaign about recycling says on one of the billboards, it's kind of like, well, duh, you drink it, you bin it. Well, duh, we're all going to get recycled. Stand back from whatever it is that you're so feeling so precious about. And just that. So this is why when we're trying to help ourselves learn or other people learn how to regulate emotionally, why we say, just take a deep breath, right? Like, that's a physiological expression of that idea. Just stand back. This stuff all sounds almost banal, doesn't it, sometimes? But I think it's actually core. Now, even if that doesn't sort of land for us, it's a bit obvious that as humans, we're a different category of thing than a lump of rock. So we might have that in common materially, but I think we would tend to think of ourselves in some significant ways as different from a rock. I'm going to take that as a given. We're born, among other things, and anybody that's ever been present for that as a participant or as an observer, just this, in terms of humanness, is utterly astonishing. I know other beings, living beings, have live births as well. I also find that astonishing. But what? Right? There wasn't, now there is. We grow, we die. Also a remarkable experience to be present for. This one I would be curious about in terms of show of hands, as you're comfortable. How many of you have had occasion to be in the room when somebody breathed their last? I mean, it's a staggering thing to be present to. It really is. And even in the midst of our grief in many of those occasions, it's still, at least for me, I'm like, what just happened? What was that? In the same way that I feel at a birth. What just happened? This is astonishing. This is over the horizon of my ability to apprehend. Right? So we have this in common. We really do. Now, as I said, we have that in common, the live, grow, die, with lots of living things, including plants and other animals. And so while it does distinguish us from rocks, it only goes so far. So if we're continuing to kind of drill down into this, what do we all have in common? I would say that the next layer of what it means to be human and to have humanness in common is that we have conscious experience. We feel pain, we experience pleasure, we're sentient. Now, again, there are limitations to this as a distinguishing feature because this is a trait we might share to some degree, at least with other living beings. I kind of like this definition. This is neurobiologist Francisco Varela. Varela defines sentient forms of life as distinct from, let's say, plant forms of life by saying that sentient beings, quote, have the ability to move oneself from here to there. Okay. So by that definition, if a being can move its whole body from one place to another to escape danger, survive, obtain food, reproduce, then we could regard that being as sentient. I think that's an interesting definition. We could take that to mean that a living sentient being is one that has the ability to feel pleasure and pain and to respond to those feelings, even if those responses are mostly or even entirely instinctual. Still a sentient being by that definition. And I don't want to get into the weeds on this, but this ability to respond to one's surroundings with conscious experience is the beginning, generally speaking, of what we mean by mind. By having a mind. But even at this level of consideration of what do we have in common, what does it mean to have humanity in common, we still have these abilities in common with lots of other animals, right? Including other mammals and birds. And if we start to consider what a universal or shared ethic might look like on that basis, we're still mostly talking about being guided by what will help us avoid suffering and be drawn toward what is pleasant. It's important stuff, and we all do it, but so can my dog. And although she's very cute and quite dear to me, she's not a human. We get confused linguistically about this. And I'm sorry if that offends anyone. Push come to shove, that does change our behavior. That's why if it comes to that, this is a painful illustration perhaps, but I think it illustrates an extremity, so I'm going to use it. That's why if it comes to that, we might decide to put an animal down without there being a society-wide raging debate about whether that's ethical or not. Painful? Probably not a debate. But ethical? different matter, right? It's also why we train soldiers to think of opposing forces as the enemy, as a category. It's to depersonalize them so that the soldiers can do the job that soldiers are required to do, potentially, functionally. That's the role, right? So we have to, so we can do this deliberately in a bunch of different directions. That direction, but also the other direction, or, which is what we're trying to do here. And I think that's where it gets interesting. We can not only, as a species, we can not only feel and respond to pleasure and pain, but we can also have thoughts, imagination, memory, and emotions. We can self-reflect on all of those experiences. We can encounter not only matters of the mind, but what we might also call matters of the heart. Our language fails us somewhere right around here. We can use memory to project our thoughts into the past, and we can use our imagination to project our thoughts into the future. It's why when world leaders behave in ways that are confusing, we experience anxiety, right? We're not in the office having that experience. There may be no imminent threat to us, but we can project our imagination into the future and imagine a threat to us. We can imagine pain as distinct from pleasure, and we can experience anxiety. All right, so now we're starting to get to the ground that we share with fewer and fewer other living things. We can use our imagination to communicate through symbols, what we commonly think of as language. And perhaps most distinctly, as a species, we have the ability to critically evaluate and compare different outcomes in both real and imagined situations. We have the capacity for both intuitive and rational thought at a level that is much more sophisticated than, as far as we know, any other living beings. And on top of that, we have, I would argue at least, an instinctive capacity for empathy. When we see someone or hear something about someone in pain, if we're sort of in a healthy space, I'm going to say, we will have an instinctive response to that suffering. Whether we actually act on it or not, we will also likely have an urge to do something about it, or a sense that something needs to be done about it. And on the happiness side, so that's sort of on the suffering side, on the happiness side, we have similar responses to sharing in someone's happiness. It's one of the reasons why we love a good book or a movie, why we have some of the conversations we have in community time that share both things that are really difficult for us, but also things that are potentially joyful, right? This is one of the reasons why we love that, a good book or a movie, or we get a kick out of trying, maybe it's just me, but I doubt it, trying to elicit a smile from a baby, from somebody who doesn't yet have language in the formal symbolic sense of the word. But we feel like a hero when we do it, right? You know, like, yes. So that's that part of it. So this matter of how we deal with happiness and suffering, as big categories, takes us closer to answering the what does it mean to be human question. Happiness and suffering, for us as humans, unlike those of other animals and other living beings, is not straightforward. When our pup shattered one of her back feet, one of the options that the vet offered for remediation of this was amputation, explaining, among other things, that our dog would not feel self-conscious about being a tripod. She would just figure out how to get around on three legs and she'd carry on. She wouldn't feel shame or humiliation. Like, the vet had a pretty good handle on the anthropomorphization that was potentially going on for the owners on the other side of this conversation, which I appreciated and is one of the reasons why I would return to that vet, right? That's a human thing. So that's very different, right? The potential dog experience with that loss of a limb, that's very different from the human experience, isn't it? I haven't, in the course of my different adventures with my vision, I have not gone blind. I can still see. But I've had to think about what it might be like to not be able to see. And I got to tell you that I don't have to go down that path very far before I'm like, I'm talking about questions of identity. I'm talking about questions about who would I be if I didn't have this sense in some functional way. And that water gets pretty deep pretty fast. That's water, if the vet was right, that my dog doesn't go swim in. Right? This is different for us as human beings. Now, if I want to make that dog happy, all it takes is a treat and a cozy place to have a nap. And I might also enjoy a treat and a nap, but they're not enough to bring me what I would call genuine satisfaction. In fact, if I nap too long, I might wake up feeling more like I have a hangover than like I'm refreshed, right? So even a thing that feels like, oh, that's nice, isn't categorically always awesome. We could observe that our never-ending quest for happiness and avoiding suffering also explains a lot about our greatest human achievements. It goes a long way toward explaining the evolution of our big brains, for example. It's also a pretty reasonable way to consider why we make religions, which is interesting. Over the course of our lives, maybe even this very day or very hour, we will face or are facing problems that are beyond our control. We're going to sing what for me is at least a cherished Brandi Carlile song later this morning. And in rehearsal, there was one point at which Jane has the lead on the song, and Jane flipped day and night around in the lyrics in the rehearsal. And it was like, on the edges, what's the line, Jane, about on the edges of the night may bring you sorrow. And in rehearsal, you sang just in a little brain moment, on the edges of the day may bring you sorrow. And I said, well, that's still the true line, like, right? And so like that can happen any time, the kinds of things that cause us to need to consider how we will face and live with suffering. We have a lot of agency, but it's also far from limitless. And some of our most profound human experiences, like the ones I've mentioned, like birth and death, remind us that that is the case. Now, that reality could be a cause for despair, and it's certainly not unusual for that reality to be the cause of some existential crisis. But we also have a deep shared drive to maintain hope, to keep our spirits up in the face of those kinds of realities. And so one of the things as humans that we've done over time because of those truths is we develop what we might broadly call faith. We develop belief in ideas that we can't empirically demonstrate. Beliefs, as distinct from facts. Doesn't mean beliefs can't contain facts, but they contain many things that are not facts. By the way, if you want a simple litmus test for when religion is losing its compass, watch for times when it insists that it can empirically demonstrate that it's big T true. Because that's not its job. That's actually not the realm in which we make it. Its job is to nurture the spiritual aspect of our lived experience. If religion isn't nurturing the spiritual aspect of our lived experience or providing us with tools to access and nurture the spiritual aspect of our lived experience, it is arguably not doing what it is there to do. And for sure it's not doing what it should do better than anything else, arguably, that we make does that. Philosophy would come close. And using terms for ideas here, they overlap, don't they? We do something similar to seek happiness and avoid suffering with science and technological innovation. Something very similar to what we do with religion. And if you've ever wondered about the connection between science and tech and avoiding suffering, for instance, just check out all the time and energy that has gone into the science of living longer. If we didn't care about avoiding that suffering, we wouldn't invest in trying to deter it. We care about it, right? And we apply ourselves to that. And we also apply ourselves to the existential dread of that by making explainer stories. I grew up with a, you know, one of Christian rock song, the chorus of which was quite insistently, I'm going to live, I'm going to live, I'm going to live forever. Some of you know that song, perhaps, right? I mean, that's a very insistent idea. And if we have an existential dread of not living forever, it's a story frame that says, you don't have to dread that, because I'm going to live, I'm going to live, I'm going to live forever, right? So there we go. I'm just saying, we do the same thing in other ways as well. We do the same thing with a science that says, we're going to freeze you when you die, because we're going to figure out how to bring you back, and you're going to live forever. That's the same story, but with different things surrounding it to support it. It's the same dread that we're dealing with, but in different ways. So these common drives toward happiness, the religion I grew up around called it fulfillment, but I would argue that we're talking about the same thing, and away from suffering, we called that peace, could reasonably be thought of as our common human ground, what we have in common. Despite all the characteristics that differentiate us, language, gender, religion, socioeconomic status, ethnicity, many others, we have some pretty basic desires and drives in common. If we want to consider this from the science point of view, for example, the sequencing of the human genome shows us that the genetic differences between ethnicities is smaller than the genetic differences between individuals, and that those differences are minuscule compared to the commonalities. They're measurable, but just barely. Our differences are superficial compared to our commonalities, but how we express those commonalities is varied and complex and can easily be confused with the sort of difference that gives us, we feel like, a defensible reason to other someone, to treat them as not my kind of human, or even a lesser human, or even not a human. And my goodness, this is not a faraway idea. I mean, the fact that people of certain ethnicities were half human lives in our near history in terms of law on this continent. And some aspects of that law have changed within my lifetime. We could stand back and shake our head, but also this is what we all do. We don't all do it formally, but we all have to deal with this if we're looking for commonality. We all have to deal with this complexity if we're looking for what we have in common with all other persons. I'm going to leave it here. I'm just going to say that at the root of all that complexity, I think, can I defend this in an absolute sense, like big T truth? Nope, I can't. It's a belief. But I believe that at the root of all that complexity, there is a place for us to keep exploring what it means to think and act ethically, among other things, on the basis of identifying as us humans. First of all, and most of all, what do we have in common? We're human. We can benefit a great deal from starting there and then moving on. And we'll keep moving on. We'll keep exploring this with more nuance. But I wanted to kind of, like I said, drill down a little bit this morning. All right. Peace.